If you're anything like me, you spent your childhood assuming that one day you'd meet your Prince Charming. You'd get married, you'd have a nice house in the suburbs, a dog, a career, and a couple of kids. It never crossed your mind that Prince Charming wouldn't come along, or that tragically you'd lose him before his time, or that your marriage wouldn't work out, or even that your biological clock would have other ideas. Or maybe you never really wanted that sort of happily ever after. Maybe you never wanted a man, but you did know you always wanted children. We're living in an age where, for the first time, women can embrace motherhood on their own terms. They no longer have to put their lives on hold waiting for the right man, or settling for someone who they know isn't right for them, just so they can become a mother. More women than ever before are embarking on the journey to become what's known as a solo mother by choice. And while for a lot of us it doesn't feel like a choice, but more a necessity, the bottom line is there are now options for you to be able to fulfill your dreams of motherhood if the traditional route isn't playing out as expected. The No Need for Prince Charming podcast will share stories of Australian women who have successfully become solo mothers by choice. They each have a unique story as to why they decided to pursue motherhood in this way and the journey they had to go through to make this dream a reality. The hope is that by sharing these stories, you'll have the knowledge and the confidence to embark on this amazing journey yourself if you determine it's the right one for you. In the words of Walt Disney, all of our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. All you need is faith, trust, and a little bit of pixie dust. Hello and welcome to the No Need for Prince Charming podcast. Today's episode is proudly sponsored by City Fertility. With a diverse range of sperm donors to choose from and no waiting time, City Fertility are ready to help you fulfill your dreams of growing your family, just like they helped me grow mine. Visit City Fertility today to learn more. So welcome to the podcast today, Brooke. Brooke is here for a very special episode. She is the National Donor and Surrogacy Manager at City Fertility. She's going to talk to us all about sperm, egg and embryo donations and how they are managed throughout Australia with City Fertility, Adam and Eve. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I think it would be a great place to start just to understand about City Fertility and how the different donor banks work together and where you come into the picture.
Sure. So City Fertility established both Adam and Eve, which are our online donor selection platforms. They're both either a website or an app. Mm-hmm. And patients are able to go onto the websites and have a look through the donors that we have available. They can review baby photos, medical history, genetic testing results, and they can review all of the donors, and then they can submit their reservations through the app or the website through to my team, and we'll process those reservations for patients.
Wow. So your team looks after all of the important parts of getting the right donor to the right people.
Yes, it's not an automatic process. We do look very carefully at the donors and make sure they are compatible for the recipients. We want to make sure that their genetic testing results are not a match. And we also want to make sure that the donor is suitable for the patient's cycle type.
Wow. So I think Adam and Eve donor banks, well, the online platform that you're talking about, that's only been around for a little while. How long have City Fertility actually had access to the donor programs?
So we established our local recruitment programs in for sperm. We established that in 2011. Mm-hmm. And for our local egg recruitment program, we established that in 2014. So we have been recruiting local donors for quite some time now, and we do have a very successful program. So we do have a robust selection of donors that are available for patients to reserve.
Wow. And so what is the process that a man would go through if he was to become a sperm donor with you guys?
Sure. It's pretty similar for both sperm and eggs. The first step that a donor is going to do is to complete a medical history form. So that is a medical history for both the donor and also their family. So unless a donor is able to provide us with a full medical history, they may not be able to donate, be included in the program. We have a responsibility to be able to provide recipients with a full medical history of the donor.
Is there anything in a medical history would mean that a donor couldn't become a donor, or is it just more for transparency about what's in the history?
We work all of our donors up in accordance to the ASRM guidelines. So that's the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. Mm-hmm. If someone had a history of ASD in their family, so autism, we would not include them in the program. ADHD is something that is very common at the moment, and we would be looking at how that affects the donor's family. There's a lot of neurological conditions that would exclude donors from the program, such as schizophrenia, bipolar, those types of conditions.
And that's more if that's the donor rather than in the donor's family, or is it both?
It's both the donor and their family.
And so women are the same, they complete, if they're going to be an egg donor, they complete that. And if it was an embryo donor, would it be, I'm assuming, both
Yeah,
contributors?
so yes. So we work up our donors, our embryo donors in accordance to the ASRM guidelines as well. We're going to be looking, so because those embryos are already created, we'll be looking at both the sperm provider and the egg provider's medical history and their family's medical history to make sure that they're suitable to be a donor as well.
Brilliant. So they get past the first hurdle that their medical history is acceptable. What happens after that?
For the guys, we will do a semen assessment to make sure that the sperm is suitable to be included in the program. We would then do infectious disease screenings. They would complete genetic testing screening as well. They also complete counseling sessions, so to discuss the implications of becoming a donor, and then they consent to the process as well.
Wow.
Yeah,
So they might learn
from
something about their own genetic history that they weren't aware of during this process too.
Yes, of course. I would have no idea what my genetic testing results would be. And when we look at when we look at genetic testing, 80% of the population will be a carrier for some type of condition. So it is very important that we are checking genetic testing results for both donors and recipients.
And once they've passed all of that, so when you're looking at the sperm quality, sorry, are you looking at the again things that if they're not good enough quality, they couldn't be included in the program? Or would it mean that they'd be isolated to maybe just IVF rather than IVF and IUI?
It's a combination of both. So we work all of our donors up in for sperm parameters against the World Health Organization standards. So there's certain parameters that you have to meet to be allowed to be used for IUIs, and different parameters for IVF. So if a donor doesn't meet the IUI parameters, he may meet the IVF parameters, and so he would only be offered to patients accessing IVF treatment.
And he might not meet either, and then unfortunately he can't become a donor.
Yes.
And so he's met all the criteria, and then what's the process that they have to go through once they've been accepted to then become a donor?
So once they've filled out their medical history, they've done those infectious disease screenings, and the counselling and the consenting, we would then ask them to come in to provide us with samples, so to actually donate. The donors can donate anywhere from 5 to 10 times until we have sufficient supply of sperm to offer out to patients. Once that we have that sperm in storage, we then quarantine that sperm for 3 months, and the donor comes back to recomplete their infectious disease screenings.
Okay, so they've done it at the beginning and then again at the end. So before it's released, it's squeaky clean, as we say.
Yes, yes, it's always checked before we release it.
Do you get many people who just make one-off donations, or are all of them coming in to do multiple donations?
Not the unknown donors. We require them to come in to do multiple donations. Where you would have donors coming in just to do one donation would probably be for a known donor program, where they are readily available to come back to produce more if needed.
And they're just for a specific person rather than available to anyone.
Yes, that's correct.
And does one donation equal one sample, or can it be split into multiple samples? How does that side work? When we hear, I've got a vial of sperm, is that just from one?
Yes. We use one vial per cycle. whether it's IUI or an IVF cycle. But donations can be split from one sample. So if a donor comes in, it really depends on the quality and the volume that we receive from that donation. And that could vary from donation to donation. So sometimes we can get a few vials, sometimes we'll only get one vial.
Okay, out of the one sample. Are they given guidelines about how to make their sample as good as possible? I'm just thinking, coming and going, I'm going to be the
Yes. They are told, it's really important to have a healthy lifestyle, so a healthy diet and to exercise and make sure you're hydrated. So we do give them those guidelines before they come in through and donate.
And what are you seeing is kind of the age range of the donors that you're getting at the moment? Do they tend to be older or younger? And does that affect the sperm samples?
So to be included in the program, donors need to be between the ages of 18 to 46 years for sperm donors. On average, our average sperm donor is 34 years old. We do find at times that the younger sperm donors, their samples may not be as good as the slightly older guys.
Interesting.
And we put that down to lifestyle factors. When you're 18, you're probably at uni. You've just discovered drinking. You're probably eating a lot of fast food.
Probably not hydrating well.
Usually the sperm quality is not at par for an 18-year-old compared to someone in their 20s.
And what are the family limits when it comes to sperm donors? Does that differ from state to state, and how does that work?
It does, and it's really confusing. Each state in Australia has different legislation, or in Queensland, no legislation. So it can be quite difficult to manage family limits. So if we look at Victoria, they have a 10 woman or person limit, whereas New South Wales has a five family limit. Queensland, with no legislation, uses NHMRC guidelines, and so we as a clinic have a 10 family limit, and WA has a five family limit, which is worldwide, so that's even more restricting.
Oh, wow. I have had a few WA guests recently and have heard how hard it can be for them to access sperm. Would it be a limit, an option for them to get sperm from another state, or would they need to do treatment in another state to then be adhering to those guidelines?
I suppose it really depends on the type of donor that they're looking for. So we do find that patients will move states to seek treatment, but it's very important for patients to realise that if they create embryos, say in Victoria, they may not be able to move those embryos back to Western Australia, because the family limits are so different, and you would also require VASA approval to remove the embryos from the state. So that can be quite restricting. We actually have a really robust program in WA. So at the moment, we have 18 sperm donors available in WA. We've started recruiting local sperm donors over there, and that's been extremely successful. We have noticed that with a lot of the donors, they're FIFO workers, so fly in, fly out workers, and trying to coordinate donations with their working schedules can be a little bit tricky.
Yeah,
Yeah,
imagine.
it slows down the process a little bit, but we have been quite successful over there. And we have also managed to import sperm from the World Egg and Sperm Bank into WA.
So when they're saying that there's a five family limit worldwide, does that mean if you're going to one of those international banks that you're getting a donor from there that's only available to WA?
The donor may be used in other states, but there can only ever be five families created worldwide from that donor.
Wow. That's a challenging one, isn't it? I know a lot of people who have gone through Seattle Sperm Bank or other places like that, and the family limit tends to be more for the country rather than worldwide. So, wow.
Yes.
And so you look after all the international donors as well?
Yes, we do. We have partnerships with the with Seattle Sperm Bank and the World Egg and Sperm Bank for our sperm donors. And then for our egg donors, we also have partnerships with Genesis International. They are based in Malaysia and specialize in Asian and Indian egg donors. And also Mana Medical, who are based in Israel and recruit their egg donors through the Ukraine.
Wow. Is it available in all states, or is again the weird legislation between them all and it makes it challenging?
Yes, unfortunately, international donors at this stage are not available in Victoria, due to the restrictions and the regulatory body VATA, placing those restrictions on international donor banks. But we are hopeful that we will be able to import international donors into Victoria in the future.
So, if a clinic does allow international donors, are there rules that they have to adhere to?
Yes, in order to be able to import our donors from international donor banks, they must adhere to the state legislation or regulations. So that means that donors must not be paid for their donation, and they must be altruistic. They must meet the family limits in those states. They must also be counselled about the this legislation in the state, and they must also consent for use in that state.
So they'd be told, we've got a state in Australia who's interested in using your sperm. Do you consent to that being sent there?
Yes, that is correct.
And do they get told anything about, is there anything they have to adhere to in terms of being able to be contacted when the child turns 18 or access to donor sibling information or anything like that?
So in Australia, anonymous donation is no longer allowed. It's unknown donation. So any donors that are used from international donor banks have consented to the fact that their ID will be released to donor-conceived children once they turn 18 years of age.
Brilliant. And would that be the parent's responsibility to then go back to that international bank where they came from, or is that something that the your team could help facilitate or someone else?
Yeah, it depends on the state. So if we were using a international donor in New South Wales, that donor's details would go onto the donor conception register in New South Wales. So they would be responsible for releasing that information to a donor conceived child. In Queensland, where we do not have a donor conception register, it would be the responsibility of the clinic to release that information to the patient.
And how long is the waiting list currently to access donor sperm or eggs, embryos? And does that differ between states?
We don't have a wait list for eggs and sperm. So as soon as you are donor ready, you are able to go on to Adam and Eve and review the donors that we have available and place a reservation. Embryos is a different story though. Embryos, we do have a wait list. Embryos don't become available as often as sperm and eggs do. So there is a wait list that is managed by the clinics.
Individual clinics. And is there an age cutoff on when you're able to access the different donor lists?
We treat patients up until the age of their 51st birthday.
Oh, wow.
After that, we are unable to treat them. So there is no age restrictions.
As long as you're under 51, you can get access to the lists. Yeah.
That is correct.
And how often should someone check back in who's trying to access donors to see if a new one has become available if there wasn't, say, one that fit the criteria?
We tend to release new donors onto Adam and Eve at the start of the week. So probably Monday night is a good time to have a look. But donors can be released back onto Adam or Eve on a regular basis. So as patients cycle through using those donors, they may have a negative outcome, and then that donor will be then released back onto Adam and Eve for other patients to reserve. So it
So,
can change on a daily basis.
just because you select a donor, that's just for that cycle. It's not that your donor going forward until you get a positive.
So we allow patients to reserve either one or two vials of sperm. We use one vial per cycle. So if a patient wants to reserve two vials, they can. That's two cycles worth of sperm. So that family spot is theirs until they have cycled with that donor. But once a negative outcome has been entered onto our database, that is then the trigger for when a donor is released back out onto Adam if the cycle has been unsuccessful.
Did wonder how that works. I'm learning about other people using my donor, and my daughter's four, almost four, and it's like, how are they only just using them now? Okay, now it makes sense. So could you reserve one, and then is there an amount of time that you, a maximum amount of time before you actually use them? Or could you?
So our reservation period is for 6 months. At the end of the 6 months, if you haven't used the sperm or the eggs, we would contact the patient and ask what the intentions were. If they were intending to use it shortly, we would extend that reservation period out for another 6 months. But once you have a pregnancy, we will allow sperm or eggs to be stored and reserved for 2.5 years. But we would always reach out to a patient at that 2.5 years mark to see what their intentions were. If they were going to use it in the next 6 months, we would obviously extend it out for another 6 months.
And so, if they were successful and then they're wanting to add to their family in future, are they best to reserve additional vials at that point to ensure that they've got it? Or is there a way that they can get more sperm later if it's, say, it's all used up by the time they get around to a sibling?
Your safest option definitely is to reserve more sperm straight away. But you will need to have to pay for the storage of that sperm. So sometimes that is not financially viable for some people. We would always encourage patients to reach out to us and ask how much sperm is available. And we can always put alerts on the donor's charts that when we get down to, say, 10 vials, we can contact that patient to see if they're interested in reserving more sperm at that point.
Well, that's a good idea. Yeah, if you think that a sibling is likely in the future and say you only got one embryo and you're successful, then it's good to know that options to reserve it for full genetic siblings.
Yes, I do think it's always very important for patients to manage their expectations about availability of donors. It's not an unlimited resource. There are stock levels, and we will always reach out to a patient to a donor and ask them to come back and redonate if they're available to. But it's not always possible. So it is important to manage expectations. That is not a given that you will have a sibling with that same donor. We'll always try our best to do that, but it is not a given.
Good to be aware of. And with the donors that you do get, there's obviously a family limit that they adhere to. Do some of them say, actually, I don't want to donate to that many? Can they say, I only want to donate to five, say, if they're in Victoria with a 10 family limit?
Yes. Donors can tell us that, and we will honour their wishes.
And is there one of those, say it's 10 families in Victoria, is one of those spots actually for their own children as well, if they were to have them?
Yes, it depends on the state. So in Victoria, if the donor has a family already, we automatically hold one spot for that family. But then as part of our conditions of registration, we also need to hold another family spot in case they have another family. So you're already dropping that 10
Right.
women down to eight women in Victoria. In New South Wales, it's the same. We'll hold a family spot for the donor as well, so that drops it down to four families. If yeah,
Okay.
and in WA, it's five families excluding the donor's family. So the donor can have their family, and then we can create another five families.
Right. Oh, it's complex, isn't it?
It's fun to manage.
What should women consider when they're selecting a donor?
I think patients need to be aware and manage their expectations about donor availability. When you go onto an international donor bank's website, you will see hundreds of donors. Not all of those donors can be used in Australia. Most of those donors will have been paid, and they will never be able to be used in Australia. So you may only have 15 donors that you can choose from. And that is pretty good availability in Australia. I think it's important that patients look at the donor's medical history to make sure that the medical history is relevant to their medical history. I think that is important.
Yeah. And also for people to think this isn't a prospective partner, this is, you know, the genetic father of any resulting children. So you may not have the luxury of choosing all of the hobbies and educational level that you think that you will. So it's prioritizing what's really important to you is that ethnicity, so your child looks the same as you, or that, like you said, the medical history.
Yes, I think a medical history is very important to look at, to make sure that, say, the donor's got a history of cancer in the family. Do you have a history of cancer in the family? Maybe that's not the right donor for you. Maybe you need to look at another donor. Yeah.
And how much time do you think women really have to select their donor? It's obviously it's just going to delay them starting treatment, isn't it? So
we require patients to have selected their donor before they start cycling. We would like to have the sperm in their clinic before they start. So I would encourage patients to select a donor quite quickly. If you see a donor on Adam or Eve that you like, reserve it. There's only a certain amount of donors that we have available, and there's only a certain amount of family limits available. So if you see a donor that you like, reserve him. Yeah, don't wait a couple of weeks, he will be gone.
Unfortunately, it's not like Hollywood would lead you to believe that you get big books and that they're all copious amounts available. It's not like that here.
It's not at all.
So if we think about the donors when they're going through this process, what's the most common reason that they give for why they want to be a donor and donate?
When we ask donors why they want to donate, most of them say that they've seen someone in their family or friendship group go through infertility treatment. So that has been a real trigger for them. Some donors say that they actually don't want their own children, but they're happy to pass to help someone else create a family.
And what proportion of donors would indicate that they're open to connection before the child turns 18, given it's an unknown donor situation?
It really depends on the donor. There are some donors that are available that are happy to make themselves available for early release of identity, but not all donors are happy to have their identity released before the donor's conceived child turns 18. So it's a case-by-case basis, I suppose. But to manage expectations, I wouldn't go into the reservation process expecting that your donor would be happy for early release of information.
Good advice. You obviously do lots of health checks when you're onboarding a donor. Are there additional checks that are done, like a police check or anything like that?
No, we do not do police checks. We encourage our donors to be open and honest with us, and we do tell them they have a legal obligation to be open and honest with us. We have done this for a long time, and we do get red flags.
Okay.
So if someone provides us a medical history that has nothing on it, we're not going to believe that. Everyone has a medical history. You know, people in your family have died from something. Someone has asthma. Someone has eczema. Putting something down on your medical history will not exclude a donor from the program. We just have to make sure that we're providing accurate information to our recipients. So we do talk to the donors along the way, and we are able to tease out more information. They do have a fertility assessment with a clinician or a GP, and we do talk through the medical history at that point. And we always encourage our donors to reach out to their family to let them know that they are donating and to get a comprehensive medical history.
Yeah, probably good if they do as well, because if they end up meeting some resulting children in future life, they don't want to be a massive shock to their wider family.
Yes.
So say someone has reserved sperm and they've been successful in creating embryos. Is there anything that would stop them moving those embryos to another clinic or, say, to another state, or even the sperm that they've reserved? Is that an option?
So we can release embryos created from donor gametes to other IVF providers. We're more than happy to do that. But we do need to make sure that we're still adhering to the family limits for that state. So, say you've created embryos in Queensland where the family limit is 10, and you wanted to move those embryos to New South Wales, more than likely you would not be able to move those embryos because the family limit in New South Wales is 5.
Right, and they've already had 10. Yeah.
We also do not release clinic recruited donor sperm or eggs from City Fertility or Rainbow Fertility clinics. It must be used within our clinics.
So the only option you've got of moving is possibly embryos.
Yes, that is correct. We have clinics in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, and Western Australia. So there's many clinics around Australia that you can move your embryos to or sperm to if it meets the family limits in those states.
Good things to be aware of if you are considering that there could be a move in future. Potentially, it's for a sibling that you're wanting to create. You might have to go back to that state to have treatment for that.
That is correct.
And if, say, for some reason you didn't get on with the specialist, it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to move that to another clinic that's not the same brand.
Yes, we have lots of clinicians in lots of clinics. We have lots of city fertility clinics these days. So we would hope that you would be able to find a doctor that is suitable for your needs.
And it's the same if you've created an embryo at a competitor brand, it's not a guarantee that you're going to be able to move it over. It's probably the same challenges.
Exactly. We need to make sure that the embryos that we're receiving meet the legislative or regulatory requirements for that state. So we would not be able to accept embryos if they had exceeded the family limit or if they were coming from an international donor bank that if the donor had been paid, we would not be able to receive those embryos.
So, do donors always meet their donor limits, or are some less? And what would be the reason they would be less?
Sometimes our most popular donors are Caucasian donors. So we will have donors in our database that are, say, Asian or Indian that will not have reached their family limits, but they are still available for other patients to reserve.
And what are the donors told about the family limits? Is there any ramifications if they were found, say, donating privately or something as well?
We always inform our donors throughout the workup process that it's very important that they are truthful and honest with us, particularly surrounding both the medical history and also donations to other IVF providers or whether they're donating privately. We're usually pretty good at picking up on the red flags. So if a donor knows too much about the donation process, that's always a red flag that you may have donated elsewhere.
Do you have any, I guess, relationship with other clinics so you can check and see if that donor has donated elsewhere, or are you just very much trusting what they say?
We also have to be very aware of privacy rules to making sure that we're not releasing a donor's information to another IVF provider. So, us reaching out to another IVF provider and providing a donor's name would be a breach of confidentiality. So, we need to be very important of that. We need to make sure we're very mindful of that.
I guess hopefully with states like Victoria that have VARTA, they would pick that up if they're donated in multiple clinics.
Yes, they would. But unfortunately, with the donation, the registers, they would pick it up once a child has been born. It would be fantastic if the Australian government could introduce a national donor register that registered donors before they donated. So similar to what they have in the UK, where once you've worked up a donor, you put them on the register to make sure they haven't registered donated anywhere else in the UK.
Would that capture private donors as well? Like, obviously, there's Facebook groups where people get donors from. There's no visibility of that anywhere, is there?
No, there's no requirement for private donors to register their donation with their donor conception register. And the donor conception registers are purely set up for IVF clinics. They're not set up for private donations. So it is something to be very mindful of if patients are wanting to access sperm donors through Facebook pages. You also need to be aware that people who are offering sperm on these private Facebook pages have probably not completed sufficient screenings. They probably wouldn't have had genetic testing. They probably don't understand the implications of being a private donor. I would assume that there would be no legal agreements set up between the recipient and the donor. And I think people need to be very mindful of that.
So we've talked a lot about sperm donors. Is there anything different when it comes to egg donors and those that you have in the bank that people should be conscious of if they're getting to that stage where they need to consider egg and sperm donors?
Yeah, the availability of egg donors is obviously smaller than sperm donors. It's obviously a lot harder to donate eggs than it is to donate sperm. Egg donors need to go through an IVF cycle to have those eggs collected. So they need to take the injections, they need to have the egg collection completed, and then we will store those eggs for patients to reserve. Your availability is going to be smaller for egg donors than sperm donors.
And would they normally have to do multiple rounds? Is there a set number of eggs you're trying to get from a prospective egg donor?
We would always encourage our egg donors to come back to provide us with more eggs. And we usually, on average, have our egg donors come back 2 to 3 times, but no more than 3 times to donate.
And is there an age cutoff for being an egg donor?
Yeah, so we have age parameters of 18 to 32 years for our egg donors.
Wow, it's so young, isn't it? I think we really take for granted how early our fertility decreases that we're just not taught about, are we? So,
no, we're not. We need to get into the schools.
Is there any circumstances where you'd take someone over the age of 32, or would that only be for a private donation?
That would only be for private donations. For our unknown program, our cutoff is 32 years, and we would not accept anyone over those 32 years. So it would only be for private donations, and that donor would need to be assessed by a fertility specialist to make sure that they should be included in the program.
They can't be paid in Australia, but is their treatment paid for? Because obviously an investment in 3 rounds of IVF is quite a lot of altruistic if they had to pay for it.
Yes, we would never want our donors to be out of pocket. So we aim to make sure that the donors don't have to pay for anything. So we, as the clinic, would pay for their cycle treatment, and we would pay for all of the workup process for them. And then we are always more than happy to pay for any reasonable and verifiable out-of-pocket expenses for the donors.
And how does the family limit change, or is it the same for egg donors?
It's exactly the same for egg donors as it is for sperm donors. Obviously, eggs are harder to get and do not move as quickly. So we don't reach family limits as quickly with egg donors as we do with sperm donors.
Yeah, 10 families would be a lot to achieve from 3 donations, wouldn't it? Wow.
Be some pretty it would
good-
be.
Everyone only just needed one.
Yes.
And I guess there would still be that one reserved for their own family as well for most of those states too.
That is correct.
So we've talked about sperm and egg donors. What happens with embryo donors? How is that different?
Embryo donors are harder to find. So usually the embryos have already been created for patients who have had treatment at City Fertility or Rainbow Fertility. They've gone through their treatment and created these embryos and had their families, and these embryos are sitting in storage. So patients will have the option to either continue storing their embryos, dispose of their embryos, or donate their embryos. And so some people choose to donate their embryos, and that's where we find these embryo donors.
And what's the process they have to go through if they've decided they would like to donate them?
Embryo donors need to complete a medical history for us, both the sperm provider and the egg provider. We need to make sure that they're suitable to be included in the program. We will also do genetic testing on both the sperm provider and the egg provider. They will complete some counselling To understand the implications of donating their embryos. They'll also consent to the process, and then we can donate those embryos to people on our wait list within the clinics.
And this is how I understand it works. It could be wrong, but the person that's kind of top of the list gets access to them and they use them. And then if they're successful, any remaining ones go back into the pool. Is that how that works? Or did I just make that up?
So we allow our patients to reserve either one or two embryos. It really depends on the patient's finances and also on the availability of the embryos. If they do reserve two embryos and they fall pregnant on using the first embryo, we can keep that second embryo in storage for 2.5 years for a sibling for them.
And is there a certain amount of time that embryos can be stored in general to be allowed into that? I've heard something about 10 years as a cutoff.
Each state has different legislation surrounding how long embryos can be stored for.
Course they do.
Yes. So it depends on the state that you're in. But embryos, sperm, and eggs can be stored for an unlimited amount of time in terms of how they are stored. It's just all surrounding the legislation of how long they can actually be stored for and the consenting process.
And if it was past that date, is there like an ethics council or something they can go to get exemption to still be able to use them or?
Once again, it depends on the state. So in Victoria, you would have to go to the PRP panel for an extension. In other states, it's just something that we would escalate to our CEO, or it's an internal process that IVF clinics manage themselves.
So all very complex. So I did have a question, what clinics have access to Adam and Eve donor banks, but is it just the City Fertility and Rainbow Fertility clinics that have access?
That's correct. Adam and Eve donors can only be used at City Fertility or Rainbow Fertility clinics.
But they're in almost every single state, so there's an easy way to do it. Because I
They
might be
are.
wrong, but I think you can access the app now and you can just look through it and everything, but you'd have to be a patient to be able to reserve it. But you can get a good idea of who's available.
Yes. So, in order to be able to reserve sperm through Adam, you need to be a patient of either City Fertility or Rainbow Fertility. You have to have had a consultation with a specialist, and also you need to have completed your genetic testing as well. 80% of the donors that we have on Adam and Eve will have a positive extended carrier status. So, we need to make sure that the recipient and the donor are not a carrier for the same condition.
Very important. Can they see that information when they're looking at the app? So say they knew they were a carrier or something, they'll be able to easily see that that donor is the same.
That information is on the profile on Adam and Eve. So patients would need to register to create an account on Adam and Eve. It only takes a couple of minutes to complete. You just have to register an email address and a verification code will be sent to you. You verify the account and then you can start looking at the extended profiles of the donors.
And do they all have photos nowadays?
The majority of them do. There are some donors that have declined to provide a baby photo. And we also have some older donors that have not consented to that. But they are on there, and you can have a look through their profiles and see if they're of interest to you.
I didn't get access to photos when I first chose my donor, but then when I rang up for a family audit, which everyone can do, a couple of years later, there were photos then available, which was amazing. So now my daughter can see photos of her donor, which is makes such a difference. I had no idea what I was picking at the time. So
And did your donor match what you thought they would look like?
I think the interesting thing for me is I just thought she was a splitting image of my dad. And so then when I saw the donor photos, I was like, oh, actually I can see that in her, which I hadn't. I didn't have anything that was obviously not from our family, so it was really interesting seeing him. Yeah.
That's lovely.
And is there anything planned by yourselves or the government to try and recruit more donors for sperm and eggs in the future?
We are always looking at new ways to attract donors to the program. We're always working with our marketing team to try and create, I suppose, fun campaigns to recruit sperm donors in particular. The Queensland government is looking at introducing legislation and a donor conception register. So I would assume that along with that, there will be quite a bit of there'll be quite a bit of news interest, and so that may create awareness about people becoming sperm donors or egg donors.
Yeah, there's just a growing need for it, isn't it? Have you noticed in the last few years that the number of solo women has increased, or do you not get access to that visibility?
We find through City Fertility and Rainbow Fertility that the majority of the patients accessing sperm donors is about 60% same-sex female couples. There's about 30% being single women, and then 10% being heterosexual couples needing to access donor sperm.
Wow, has that changed quite a bit over the years?
I don't particularly think so. It really depends on the state as well, and the I suppose the access that they have to international donor banks compared to local donors, and the availability of donors within their state.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Brooke. I have learned so much today. Is there anything else that you just wanted to leave with any of our listeners that you'd want them to be aware of with the Adam and Eve or embryo donor banks?
I would always encourage patients to go and have a look on Adam and Eve and have a look at the donors that we have available. And if you have any questions, my team is always available to take any phone calls or emails and answer any questions that you do have.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Brooke. It's been very enjoyable getting to know all of this information.
Not a problem.
I'm Alicia, and this is the No Need for Prince Charming podcast, bringing you stories of Australian solo mums who created their own happy ending. If you like what you heard, please follow or subscribe to make sure you don't miss out on future episodes, and leave a like, a review, or share with your friends to help others find it easier. Bye for now.